UK Wine Show, show number 203. Claudio Sagato, Director of Projects of the Hyatt in Hong Kong. G'day, my name's Chris Scott and welcome to this week's UK Wine Show. This week we're talking with Claudio Salgato. He is the Director of Projects at the Hyatt in Hong Kong, and his responsibility is the food beverage areas for all the new hotels in Asia being built by the Hyatt at the moment. I think he talks about 23 currently underway at the moment. So we're going to be talking with him about Hong Kong, China, and the Asian wine industry from the Hyatt's point of view. This week they let me out of jury service early, so I've done about 1 week and a bit, but I'm still well behind on everything, partly because of that and partly because just really busy time of the year for me. So this show I'm actually recording on Sunday, well after the Friday, so sorry about that guys, but it is running a wee bit late. I did find jury service a wee bit frustrating, letting guilty people off and not coming to conclusions on one case, but better than my neighbour who I just spoken to. She's on jury service and she's going to be on there for 2 to 3 weeks, which is quite a long time for a single trial. And she's one of the people working on Eurostar, dealing with the customer service. Seemingly it's very busy with all the flights in Europe being cancelled. On the positive side, though, we normally have to record this show between flights. We're not really under the Heathrow flight path, but about once every 2 weeks, or when the weather's really nice, like it is at the moment, they change the direction. The planes come over our house. So I have to land up, record a bit, stop, wait for a plane to fly over, record a bit, stop, wait for a plane to fly over. So at the moment, it's nice and quiet, so I'm really enjoying that. Oh, well, that's enough of the weather, airplanes, and all that sort of stuff. Let's crack on with this week's show. And we're going to start this week with our mystery region. I'm going to give you the first clue now and the other clues after the interview, which is coming up later on. So the first clue is, our mystery region has very little rain in summer months, so irrigation is necessary. Fortunately, water is plentiful, with snow melt supplying the rivers flowing from the mountains. Frost is also rare, so the main risk to vines is La Piedra. I think I said that right. La Piedra. It's a hail that comes early in summer. Vines are planted at altitude on sandy alluvial soils. Maipo is probably the most common subregion that you're going to see on wine labels, but there's also others including Lushan, San Martin and San Rafael. Have we think about that? It does sound a wee bit like another wine region, but you should be able to work it out. Have a think about it while we're having the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Cheers, Chris. A former boss of Rivers Wines in Adelaide has been found guilty of selling Chardonnay adulterated with Sultana grape juice. Andrew Hashim was convicted on 34 counts of falsifying records, and in 2007, Rivers Wines pleaded guilty to 97 counts of the same charge. The scam was first uncovered in 2003 when grape juice was quarantined by the Australian Wine and Brandy Corporation after winemakers suspected foul play. One of the buyers was Hardy's, who brought the matter to the attention of the authorities. At the time, Chardonnay grapes were selling for $1,000 Australian dollars per tonne, while Sultana grapes were worth $250 a tonne. Rivers Wines now faces a maximum penalty of $1.4 million Australian dollars, while Hashim could be fined up to $102,000.
Well, it's not just those in south of France who've been tricked into using the wrong grape varieties. It just goes to show where there's an opportunity to make money, fraud is always around. What's the next story, Jane?
Well, according to latest data for the year ending March 2010, New Zealand has overtaken Germany in sales to the UK off-trade market, that's supermarkets and retail outlets. The data shows New Zealand has a 3.3% share by value and grew by 4.6% over the year, with an average retail price of £6.05 per bottle. So still quite high. David Cox of New Zealand Wine Growers conceded there had been some price discounting, which had influenced the performance of New Zealand wine, but that consumer loyalty in the UK remained strong.
Go New Zealand! Prices have maintained reasonably well, even with a huge vintage, but I did get some negative feedback about New Zealand wine when I was in Australia. The sommeliers I'd spoken to at various restaurants, and I didn't go to too many, but a few, said they were just getting a bit over New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, which is always a worry because they're often the gatekeepers. But given New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc is one of the most popular styles of white wines in Australia at the moment, and I think the Aussies are getting getting a lot of it drunk down their throats, it's not surprising they're getting a wee bit tired of it. Speaking of sommeliers, though, judging of the world's best sommelier competition has just finished. What's going on there, Jane?
Well, a competition to find the world's best wine waiter has been won by Gerard Bassett, who owns the Hotel Terrafina in Hampshire and was the founder of Hotel Duvan. He was awarded the title of World's Best Sommelier this week in Santiago, Chile. It was his sixth time in the competition and the fourth time that he'd reached the finals. The prestigious competition, held every 3 years, sees 12 finalists go through a grueling series of tests, including a timed written paper, which has to be completed in another language. It covers all aspects of sommelier's work, including beers, spirits, tea, coffee, cigars and water, as well as wine. That's it from me this week, but don't forget to visit our website 3050.co.uk for these stories.
Cheers, Jane. Gerard may have won the competition, but it was the first time that a woman had made the final. This time there were 4 women finalists, so that's good going. I hope the competitions like this raise the idea of sommeliers as a profession. We're going to be talking to Claudio from the Hyatt later on. He's going to tell us a wee bit about some of the problems they've had at the Hyatt trying to recruit staff. So have we tuned for that? But next up, we have our spotlight. The spotlight this week is based on a walk I did on my last day in New York. I walked pretty much the length of Manhattan, just short of it, starting at 105th Street up near Harlem and walking all the way down to Wall Street. Quite a long walk, and as I did so, I popped into various wine stores as I went along. So today's spotlight is going to be a wee bit about my experiences walking the length of Manhattan, talking to people who run wine shops. Now, we're going to start the journey in Harlem, and for those who know New York, I traveled down 3rd Avenue from 104th to 34th Street, and then crossed over to 5th Avenue until I hit Greenwich on the way down to Wall Street, which it gets a bit higgly-piggly with the road, so I have no idea what roads I took down that way. Harlem, where we're going to start, is certainly the most rundown area in Manhattan that I saw, but not to say it is the most rundown, but it certainly is the most that I saw. Probably a bit like Brixton on a quiet day, even though when I was in Harlem, it was between, I think it was 5 o'clock in the evening on a Friday. It felt very quiet there compared to places such as Brixton, which probably has a similar vibe to it. The only wine shop that I visited was a recently opened shop. They had an insane range of wines. They had everything from Chateau Margaux, you know, Premier Cru Class A, right through to, you know, Yellowtail and below. Quite a lot of high-end wines in there, and they did say they'd brought wines in from other shops. The shop wasn't very big. It was about 5 meters by 10 meters, which isn't too bad, I suppose, compared to some of the other wine stores I visited. And I only spoke briefly with the owner, but I asked him what the most popular style was, and he said Argentinian Malbec. I then headed off on my walk. I didn't really hit any shops I visited until I hit Midtown, which is an area, halfway down, really, and certainly one of the more expensive ends of town. I stopped twice in Midtown. The first one was at a fantastic magazine store, and I purchased 6 wine magazines, 4 of which I'd never come across before. I'm actually going to review some of these magazines later on. But the wine shop I popped into in Midtown was quite a large store, and it had been running an organic wine tasting that day as well as a vodka tasting. The organic wine tasting I pretty much ignored because I wasn't really looking to taste any wines. But I did overhear a salesman telling a lady that they were sulfur-free Chablis. And I thought, ooh, sulfur-free Chablis, I'll give that a try. I've only had a few sulfur-free wines and I'm always keen to try. Especially because the vintage was 2008, which was quite old for a sulfur wine. Tried it. It was supposedly a Premier Cru Chablis, although it tasted just more like an Appellation Contrôlée Chablis. And I had a look at the back of the label. It did say that sulfurs were in the wine. Because wine produces sulfur during fermentation, I wasn't sure at the time whether they just had to put that in there because it's just a naturally part of the fermentation process. But I have looked it up since then, and wines with less than 10 parts per million don't require the label, which is pretty much all wines that haven't had sulfur added to them. So I was a bit concerned about that. And the other thing I noticed was that the wine didn't have any organic signs on it. Usually wines from France, if they're organic, they adhere to a particular organic method, and this didn't have any signage, so there's no way of knowing whether the wine was actually organic or not, and it probably wasn't certified. So a bit disappointed, because a lady bought that wine thinking it was sulfur-free and organic, where it was obviously not sulfur-free and it wasn't organic. So not a great start there. I trundled along a bit further and the next stop was in Greenwich Village. I'd say the closest you get is maybe Camden Town in London. And I popped into a really eclectic shop and it had all sorts of different wines. They did seem to have a particular emphasis on Italian wines, but they sold pretty reasonable wines between $10 and $30. Margins were claimed to be around 50%, which is pretty high. And once again, that Argentinian Malbec was claimed to be the most popular wine for them. The last wine I visited was in an area called Tribeca in Lower Manhattan. This was a tiny store, 4 meters by 4 meters, and the shop didn't carry much stock in terms of volume stock, but what they had was lots and lots of different wines. So they may have only had 3 bottles of a particular wine, but they had a lot of different range in there. And I asked him what their most quirkiest wine was, and he showed me a Van Jean from Jura, which is quite an unusual wine. And we did interview Wink Lorch about Jura wines ages ago, if you want to catch up on that. But they are a bit unusual and quite a surprise. The range was superb. And once again, Argentinian Malbec was the most popular wine. And these guys knew their wines very well. They were very slick, very professional bunch. And they were quite honest. And they said their margins down in Tribeca were between 50 and 70%, which is really quite enthusiastic. They said that because Tribeca is such an expensive area of Manhattan, prices have to be high to afford the space, which maybe is the case. I think my experience in summary was that margins in bottle shops were higher in New York than they are in the UK, and wine ranges had the expected Australian brands in there as well, but there was a lot of French wines taking pride in place. Argentinian Malbec was certainly the most popular wine from the people I spoke to, but there was a really, really, really good range of styles throughout in all sorts of shops, and certainly far better than you'd typically see in the UK high street, from what I could tell from my quick, well, not so quick, walk through town Manhattan. But the scene doesn't appear to be dominated by multiples. Some people did say they had multiple sites selling wine, but there was no one like the big odd bins in the UK, which dominate a lot of the UK high street. Margins were probably higher because grocery stores aren't allowed to, and it looks like the law change that the governor was trying to get through isn't going to make it. It means that the people make a decent profit, and as a smaller company, you can make a decent profit. And because you've got a range of people, you get a range of styles, so it's really good. From what I could tell, the New York wine scene is very different to the UK wine scene. Prices are higher, but the trade looks a lot healthier and more diverse because of it. And Argentinian Malbec is certainly the most popular wine style over there. Speaking of Argentinian Malbec, let's have a little chat about our mystery wine region, which is coming up next. The clue's coming up next, anyway. So, second clue in our mystery wine region is Malbec. It's the dominant red grape variety in our mystery region, where more than half the vineyards is made up of this red variety. However, white varieties such as Chardonnay, Sauvignon Blanc are becoming increasingly popular, and I've certainly had some nice Chardonnays from there. I'll give you the answer to our mystery wine region, and it is an Argentinian wine region, after our interview, which is coming up next with Claudio Segato, Director of Projects for the Hyatt in Hong Kong. He gives us an idea of the fast-growing Asian wine scene. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Claudio Segato. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Excellent. Do you want to tell us what you do, Claudio? You're Director of Projects at the Hyatt in Hong Kong, but what does that mean?
I've been working for Hyatt for 16 years, and most of my career was in food and beverage, running and operating restaurants and bars and banquet facilities in the hotels. And over the years and with the amount of expansion that we were having these days here in Asia, especially in China, my role ended up diverting towards planning the facilities of our new hotels rather than operating them. So today I look after the hotels we have under development, and I plan all our food and beverage facilities from an operational perspective.
How many hotels is the Hyatt developing at the moment?
We have approximately 26 hotels under development.
Wow, that's quite a bit, isn't it?
Yes, it's a very strong growth for us, and especially China. China is the main developing market for us.
Sure. The Hyatt's obviously a well-respected hotel chain around the world. Are there issues that you have to deal with in terms of setting up the hotels that maybe aren't common in other regions of the world?
Yes, certainly there are. a number of issues. We are lucky, I would say, in the sense that Hyatt has always had a strong focus in food and beverage. We operate all of our restaurants ourselves. We don't like leasing out food and beverage spaces to outside operators. So we run all of our facilities ourselves, which over the years gave us the certain advantage of having good experience in developed restaurants for the local communities where we are. In every hotel that we have, the restaurants that we develop are meant for the local community and not necessarily for the hotel guests. And we've been present in Hong Kong and China since 1969, so we have a bit of experience operating this part of the world. But when it comes specifically to wine, obviously a lot has changed over the past 10 years, and China is certainly a growing market, which is becoming more and more sophisticated every day, with people enjoying and appreciating drinking wine. It's a big difference between Hong Kong and China. Hong Kong is today a very sophisticated wine buying and wine drinking market, especially when the wine taxes were cut to zero a couple of years ago. It's really gave Hong Kong a good advantage in terms of becoming a wine hub for Asia. Mm-hmm. So this indirectly has also helped China in facilitating opening the China market for more and more wine distributors. Because the challenge we used to have in China is that the number of wines available was quite restrictive. The wine import market was dominated by a few large wine distribution, important and distribution companies.
That's the likes of Summergate and ASC, is that right?
That's correct, yes. They did a fantastic job and they were instrumental in setting up the whole wine import and wine distribution business in China. And really, I mean, we couldn't be where we are today without them. But now that things are evolving, I think it's important to have a little bit more choice. Because one of the challenges in China is that often when you go to a restaurant, you see the same wines everywhere, mm-hmm. because there was limited supply. So this has over the years been a challenge, which now we're slowly overcoming, and being able to work with some smaller wine importers and be able to be different from everyone else.
I suppose the trouble with smaller importers is that if they're too small, they may not be able to give you continuity supply, or maybe the customer services isn't as thorough as maybe some of the bigger companies.
Absolutely. This big companies, they said they play a very important role, and they were our best partners in the business, because they often provided very good customer service, helped providing training for the staff, and they were key in helping new hotels and restaurants building up a decent wine list. With smaller companies, there's sometimes this problem with continuity. They run out of stock, or vintage changes without you being notified. So I think that the important thing today is try to have a balance, because you still need to work with the large companies. But in order to differentiate yourselves, you need to look for alternatives as well.
What are some of the issues? We talked earlier about some of the issues associated with the Chinese market, because obviously you're setting up hotels in China as well. And you mentioned counterfeiting, and some people I've spoken to in Hong Kong say, no, it's not a problem. Some people say, no, it's those pesky Europeans doing all the problems. What's your experience on counterfeit wines?
We had some problems, especially when it comes to fine wines, classified Bordeaux. And the challenge is that the counterfeits are of extremely high quality. It's very difficult to spot them. And it's really only if you have an experienced sommelier in the property that knows the bottle and can sometimes spot minor differences in the label or on the foil, and then takes the time and care to compare against a genuine bottle that we sometimes spot these things. It's a growing problem, unfortunately. Percentage-wise, it represents, I would say, less than 1%.
Yeah.
But in dollar-wise, it could be quite significant when you're talking about, let's say, a 82 Latour or Petrus.
They can be quite pricey.
Yes.
When we were talking earlier, you did mention two types of buyers in China and Hong Kong. You gave two scenarios, really. Do you want to just recap what they were?
Yes, we in this part of the world, entertaining guests, it's something very important. And in Chinese, we say that when you entertain someone, you need to give face to the person, meaning you need to show respect and appreciation for the relationship, be a business relationship or whatever relationship. So when you entertain someone, you need to give the person face. And one way of doing that is by serving good quality food and drinks. Mm-hmm. So often, depending on who you entertain, you will bring the person to an expensive restaurant and then serve. If it's a Chinese meal, you're going to serve shark's fins and abalone and bird's nest and an expensive steamed garupa. And when it comes to beverage, these days you will most probably open an expensive bottle of a classified Bordeaux. This has changed over the years. In 15 years ago, people used to open an expensive bottle of XO cognac.
Yeah.
But with sophistication level increasing, I think Bordeaux's are the beverage of choice for these situations. And but on the other hand, there's the second type of consumer, which is the average drinking consumer, which is, I think, one of the biggest growing markets, both in Hong Kong and China, where people are becoming more and more savvy about what they drink and open to experience new wines from different parts of the world and different grape varietals. And so it's quite exciting to see the growth in number of people and especially among the local Chinese people drinking wine. And you see lots of wine clubs being set up and more wine bars popping up everywhere. It's quite exciting times.
You mentioned a few stories about, you know, drinking Petrus and Coke and things like that. And I think that's quite funny from one respect, I suppose. But I'm sure it's not the norm these days. But you did talk about one of the issues associated with giving face was about spending the right amount of money on the wine. And in the UK, wine lists are often defined by maybe whites or reds or grape variety. Is that the way it's done over here?
Yes, but there's a third way of listing wines that you see often in Hong Kong and China is listing wines by the price. Mm. So when you're selecting something to offer to your guests, you don't even need to look at the left side of the wine list. You just concentrate on the right side, and you just scroll down the price column until you reach a value that you think it's about right for the person you're entertaining, and then that's the wine you choose.
Is that why people keep serving me Jacob's Creek?
Come on.
Okay. I just thought I'd throw it in. What's the situation with staff? We were talking a wee bit about that you guys are currently doing a recruitment for a sommelier. Are sommeliers easy to come by in Hong Kong?
Not that easy. There is a tremendous growing interest in people in the food and beverage industry to learn about wines and eventually become sommeliers. So we have, as I mentioned to you before, here at the Grand Hyatt Hong Kong, we run WSET courses internally for our staff, and we have over 40 certified WSET staff in the hotel and in the different levels. So there's a growing demand of becoming a sommelier. The challenge that we find is when it comes to finding someone with an international experience, someone that has had a good amount of exposure in visiting wine regions and really knowing wines from all over the world, it's difficult to keep these people. What we see happening, especially in Asia, is that a lot of sommeliers, they seem to leave the business, either because they want to become hotel general managers or because they want to join wine distribution companies, because they think that perhaps they will work less, they'll have the weekends off, opposed to being working long hours on their feet in the restaurant. So the challenge actually is not in finding sommeliers, but it's in retaining them and retaining them loyal to the job.
So you're actually looking for a sommelier at the moment, but you're looking for an expat as opposed to a local Hong Kong person. What's driving you there?
The main reason is because we'd like to bring to the team someone with new ideas, someone with different background that could add to the team. And in our case, this role, we're looking for someone who will be in charge of three hotels at the same time. So we want someone that can, on one hand, lead the service teams of all three hotels, that can provide a lot of support and training to the staff, but also bring new ideas for our customers. As I mentioned before, Hong Kong is quite sophisticated these days, so it's important to always have something new to offer.
And what does a sommelier earn in Hong Kong?
Sommelier salaries can vary a lot and are very much in line with what you pay to restaurant staff, being a restaurant assistant manager or a restaurant manager. For a position like the one we're looking for, since we're looking for an expatriate person that hopefully will come to us with a good amount of experience, we are willing to pay a high salary equivalent to a director of food and beverage with a full expatriate package, because otherwise we would not be able to find such an individual.
You don't want to give us a number?
I mean, I can, but it's not sure about the accuracy of the number and the relevancy.
No, that's fine. That's fine. Hong Kong's quite a small island, and land prices are quite expensive. What does that mean for things like your cellars? Do you have big cellars at the Hyatt here?
No, we don't. We have a good amount of temperature control cellar in the hotel that to fulfill the operation of our restaurants, but we don't necessarily cellar wines for aging.
Yeah.
And the reason for this is, one hand, because the value of the real estate, it's so high that it doesn't justify converting usable space into storage, when at the same time, the amount of wine available in Hong Kong is tremendous. And the city is so efficient that it's so easy to work with wine distributors that have amazing stocks of great vintages, of old Bordeaux. So for us, it's just easier to keep a minimum amount in the hotel, keep reordering on a daily basis.
Just-in-time service, really, isn't it? What about some of the restaurants and hotels in China? Do you keep stocks in those hotels?
Yes, in China, we tend to have a lot bigger wine cellar, wine storage spaces. First, because cost of land is not as high as in Hong Kong, and we're able to carve out spaces in the hotel to store wine, and because of the challenges that I mentioned before with stock continuity and certain vintages changing and not being available, we tend to stock a lot more.
Yesterday, I went off and I thought I'd get myself a nice bottle of wine just to drink, because I was working late in my hotel last night, and I popped into a shop called Bordeaux, I think it was, or Bordeaux Fine Wines, in Pacific Park or Pacific Way?
Pacific Place.
Pacific Place, that's yes. the one. And funnily enough, they had a Cloudy Bay there for sale, and they also had a Stoneleigh Riesling and a Oyster Bay, and they're all about the same price of around £20 a bottle, which I was quite surprised because £20 a bottle for Cloudy Bay I was fine with. £20 for Oyster Bay I was like, that seems a bit inappropriate. Is that a typical shop in Hong Kong? Did I just find the wrong shop, or is because I haven't really seen a lot of wine shops around?
There are some, but not that many. And the wine shops in Hong Kong tend to be rather small compared to what you would find in the UK or.
Oh, this was a meter deep and yeah. about 4 meters wide. It was tiny.
But about them charging you the same amount for Oyster Bay. Compared to Cloudy Bay, I think someone made a mistake with the price tag. Because yeah. Oyster Bay, you can find it easily in supermarkets here.
Yeah.
So what happens in Hong Kong is independent wine shops, you don't find that many. And that has a lot to do with real estate cost. Most wine import companies, they work very strongly with private customers and they direct sell to private customers either through their newsletters or their websites. And that's a very strong market for them. And Hong Kong being small, deliveries can be done quickly within the day. People just feel comfortable in calling the wine importer and placing an order, and they have the wines delivered at their door the next day.
I think we'll wrap it up there, Claudio. Thank you very much for your time.
Welcome, my pleasure.
Cheers. Hope you enjoyed that interview with Claudio. Claudio gave us some issues associated with the wine business in Asia, especially about Hong Kong being quite small in size and how they deal with that with stocking and how they deal with their clients compared to something like China where they can carry a large range of wines because the cost of land is cheaper. It was interesting that they are looking for internationally experienced sommeliers. And even though I recorded the interview about 4 weeks ago, they may still be looking for that role if anybody's interested. But Hong Kong looks just the place for a dedicated sommelier who's looking for a few years away from Old Blighty. The accommodation is expensive, but everything else seems pretty cheap. And definitely an idea for those looking for a change and an opportunity to be part of a booming wine industry. Well, any top sommelier worth their salt should have been able to work out what our mystery wine region was. So the wine region was, of course, Mendoza, one of the biggies. Now, this week, I'm not going to read you the clues again. I've decided not to rehash that. If you don't like it, send me an email. And if I get enough people saying they'd like the notes read out again after they know the mystery wine grape then or region, then I will put them in. But that pretty much ends the show, apart from this week's quote. And this week's quote is from Hilary Belloc. He's an Anglo-French writer and historian. And he was also a naturalized British citizen in 1902. He was recalling wine in his youth. I forget the name. I forget the place. I forget the name of the girl. But the wine was Shamburton. Obviously had a haunting memory for him. Until next week, though, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.